Robin Hood Radio and the Robin Hood Radio Network is proud to present Leonard Lopate at Large, lively hour-long in-depth discussions providing overviews and context to topics usually covered in partial measures. His guests include leading thinkers, scientists, artists, economists, farmers, historians, authors, and politicians. Mr. Lopate is a Peabody Award winner whose numerous honors include 3 Associated Press Awards and 3 James Beard Awards.
Welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. Blake J. Harris's latest book, The History of the Future, Oculus, Facebook, and the Revolution That Swept Virtual Reality, tells the story of how Palmer Luckey, a 19-year-old who was living and working in a camper trailer parked in his parents' driveway, created a device called Oculus VR that he hoped would initiate a broad revolution in the application of VR technology. It wowed investors and people in the industry who, along with some colorful characters, helped him create a company that less than 2 years after its founding in 2012 would be acquired by Facebook for over $2 billion. It also turns out to be a cautionary tale about how things can work in the tech industry and where you may learn too late just who your friends are. It's published by the Day Street imprint of HarperCollins and brings Blake Harris to our show. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me on. I didn't say beforehand, but I'm a longtime listener, so this is a special moment on my bucket list.
Well, I'm so glad you're here. And this is a fascinating topic, a really interesting book. Wasn't virtual reality so costly and experimental that it was unattainable outside of a few research labs and military training facilities until this guy came along?
Yeah. You know, I'm 36 years old, so I remember growing up in the 80s and 90s. And I think that, you know, in the mid-90s, if somebody from the future or someone had pulled me aside and said, hey, kid, what's going to be the technology of the future? I would have said virtual reality. We all know that. It seemed very obvious.
Well, it was in science fiction.
Right.
But it didn't seem to be in reality.
Well, in the late 80s and early 90s, you know, a guy named Jared Lanier started a company VRL research, and Nintendo had the Virtual Boy, and there was, you know, at a lot of malls, they had these installs.
By the way, I want to interrupt because I've interviewed Jared Lanier many times, and he's become a critic of the social media.
Yes.
And to some degree, the work that he did. So there are people who have misgivings about this.
For sure. And, you know, Jaron is a very small part of the book, obviously a very important part of virtual reality. He is credited as coining the term virtual reality. But I'm glad that in the introduction you mentioned the cautionary tale element of this, because as a writer going through this process, speaking with all these people over the years who lived through it, you learn a lot of things. So I'm not totally shocked that Jaron has that perspective. And I'm glad that he's speaking out, because I share some of his concerns, particularly about social media.
What did Palmer Luckey do to deliver a high-quality, immersive, and affordable virtual reality handset prototype that others hadn't been able to do?
So part of the answer is just that he was interested. You know, thinking back now, VR, virtual reality, obviously it's not ubiquitous, but it is more popular than it was back then. But you know, if you think about what the state of VR was in 2012, it really was sort of a technological punchline along the lines of flying cars or jetpacks. So the fact that Palmer had dedicated 3 years of his life from 2009 to 2012 to this technology that like less than 100 people in the world cared about, that alone is part of the reason why he was able to crack the code or start to.
And he was about 16 when he started?
Yeah, he's a homeschooled kid, a real eccentric, charismatic guy. I sort of realized after I finished the book, unfortunately, that the best way to describe him, in my opinion, is as Kevin McAllister, played by Macaulay Culkin in Home Alone. Sort of an adult version of that. You know, he's charismatic. He's a little bit arrogant, but it's almost charming. He's super resourceful. He loves coming up with things. And so one of the things that he came up with over the course of these 3 years, different prototypes, was a wide field of view virtual reality headset, meaning that with a lot of VR headsets, it was almost like you were wearing horse blinders, and you could, you know, it was good quality, but you could only see like 30 degrees field of view. So Palmer came up with something that was 110 degrees field of view, and most importantly for a homeschooled kid who wasn't super wealthy, it was affordable. It was something that you could make for a few hundred dollars.
He was a gamer, and he saw this totally in those terms. Why did he call it the Rift?
Because he wanted to basically to capture that feeling or the difference between virtual reality and reality, that there's this rift. I guess it was a pretty literal thing, but sort of capturing that abstraction between how you feel in this flesh world and the virtual world.
And you say it wasn't expensive to put together. Isn't the hardware that goes into this sort of thing fairly difficult to obtain?
I mean, yes and no. I guess it's all relative. Ultimately, the headset that him and Oculus initially sold was $300. And $300 is a lot of money. I'm not going to say that that's not much. But compared
to... less than a TV.
Right. And I guess really when I say affordable, I don't even necessarily mean to the consumer. I just mean compared to in 2011, if you had said, hey, Blake, what's the best VR headset I can buy? I would say it's... Or even what's the cheapest, I would say it's this $10,000 headset or this $100,000 headset that's in a military lab or academic research lab. So it was affordable compared to what else was out there.
Now, as I said, he intended it for use by gamers like himself. But when did it become apparent that it could be used for non-gaming purposes?
That's a good question. And it's a good question, too, because, I'm oftentimes on your side of things. I'm doing interviews with people. And the one thing that I'm sure you find as well is that so often it is passion that really drives success. And so for Palmer, it was just this passion of how can I make this thing that I want? I love video games. I want to be closer to the video game and step into the game through the computer screen. But at the same time, prior to founding Oculus in the year before, he got an internship at USC's Mixed Reality Lab. And one of the programs that he worked on was a project called Brave Mind, which did virtual reality simulations for soldiers who had returned from war who were suffering from PTSD. So I think it was apparent to him very early on that there was wider applications. In the end, whether it was Facebook's vision or Oculus's vision or Palmer's vision, everyone that I spoke with did sort of imagine this as becoming a mainstream thing that was a huge tool in education and healthcare. It's more just a question of how do we get there from a business standpoint, and gaming was the best path.
Well, hasn't Goldman Sachs predicted that VR will be bigger than TV by 2025? Now, we're talking about 6 years from now. We're all going to wind up with, VR goggles or glasses or projectors?
I thought that was a bit of an ambitious forecast on their part, but it is Goldman Sachs, and it was their forecast. And yeah, I mean, I guess part of what makes it a little easier to understand is as Mark Zuckerberg presented, I think in 2016 at Facebook's F8 conference, at the end of the 10-year roadmap, which would align almost with the 2025 number, basically it's a pair of glasses like the one I was wearing or the ones you're wearing, and you can toggle between virtual reality, which is a fully immersive computer-generated world, or augmented reality, which would be me looking at you right now in the real world and seeing, your Wikipedia page come up or hot videos from over the years.
So we wouldn't have to put on these bulky headsets and sit in the living room together.
Right.
No, I'm glad. And hope that the other person is watching the same virtual reality show we are.
Right. You're right. Yeah. So as of now, back in 2012, Palmer's original headset was very cumbersome. Now they're still a little bit bulky, but they've gotten ergonomically better. The end goal is for something that is as thin as a pair of glasses or even a pair of contact lenses.
And you said that it's already made an impact on other fields, real estate, healthcare, education. How is it applied?
Yeah, I was talking to a medical student the other day, and she was telling me how, originally, or students prior to her would tell her that, they would have to get cadavers. So you'd have to actually get human cadavers to practice on. And I'm sure that that's still a practice that goes on. But, you only have one chance at the cadaver, and what you do to that cadaver stays, as opposed to, she said that she's already done 500 simulations with a virtual cadaver. And, you can think about it like training like a video game, but you can actually bring your hands into this. So you're actually simulating very much what it's like.
And in the case of real estate, you could visit an apartment or a house without ever going there?
Absolutely. And then also on the other end of that, the creation of the building from an architectural standpoint, instead of physically making the building or even using a computer program, you can say, here's a place we could put this wall. Here's what the color could be. So you can really develop a lot of that ahead of time.
And the United Nations has touted it.
Yeah, the United Nations did a very interesting program a few years ago. They partnered with Chris Milk, the famous music video director, and they did a series of documentary films, one of which was my first mobile virtual reality experience. It was called Clouds Over Sidra, and it was, you know, you spend time at a Jordanian refugee camp, and I guess this is a very rudimentary way to put things that I'm sure people at Oculus and of these other companies wouldn't necessarily agree with, but just for the layperson like myself, you know, there's kind of two different sorts of virtual reality experiences. There's like a more like a video game, a CGI, Pixar sort of thing, and then there's more like a video, like capturing real life. And
so this could be like a documentary film
that would have
more impact because we'd actually be walking through the refugee camp.
Exactly. And so the benefit of the Pixar-like CGI one is that it's interactive because it's computer-generated. And, you know, if I push Buzz Lightyear, he'll push back. Whereas in the refugee camp one, it is more just like you're a visitor to this place. But in terms of a documentary, I found it to be much more, you know, you see, feel a sense of presence. It was much more compelling. And to that point, part of the reason that the UN did this was to deliver, you know, to present it to leaders and diplomats and also to raise money. And they were way more successful in raising money with this than with traditional films or just speeches.
Getting back to Palmer Luckey, how did he raise money? Did he name his future company Oculus before he got anybody else involved?
Yeah. So Palmer's plan, this is back in April of 2012, and he founded Oculus. He described it on his original website as his tilt to try to change VR and make VR finally successful after all these years of failure. And then a funny thing happened. It was April 12th. He was in his trailer, and he received an unexpected out-of-the-blue message from a guy named John Carmack. And Palmer knew John Carmack, but for listeners who don't know John Carmack is one of the co-founders of id Software. He's the creator of games like Doom, Wolfenstein, Quake. He's credited as basically the father of first-person shooters, so for better or worse.
That's often described as a video game legend.
He's an absolute video game legend. He's as close as you get to a household name, I think, amongst video game developers. And John is a brilliant guy. He's a literal genius. And what John does is, after spending 2 or 3 years building a game, he takes a little R&D period, he told me. And again, he's a genius. So during this little R&D period, this little R&D vacation, he immerses himself in a different subject matter. One time it was rockets, which led to the creation of his company, Armadillo Airspace. You know, not the sort of vacations that you and I probably take. And then after, in 2011, after the creation of game Quake, of the game Rage, he decided to look into virtual reality. And John, who had been around since the 90s creating games, thought surely that in the 10 or 15 years since I had been looking at VR for games in the 90s, it has progressed tremendously, and was shocked to find that no, it hadn't at all. And that what was being made by Sony or companies like Imagine or Vuzix was really not that great. And then he came across this hardware hacker named Palmer Tech, who ended up being Palmer Luckey. And John was basically astounded by what this homeschooled kid had built with off-the-shelf parts.
And then later on, we'll get into where that leads to a major lawsuit. But you're listening to Leonard Lopate at Large on WBAI, New York 99.5 FM. My guest is Blake J. Harris, who is the author of a previous bestseller called Console Wars, Sega, Nintendo, and the Battle That Defined a Generation. He's written for many different media outlets. And I imagine that the previous book got you thinking about this book.
It did. I remember talking to my literary manager after Console Wars came out, and I said to him, you know, it's really sad that I'm never going to write a book as good as Console Wars for the rest of my life.
It was declared one of the best books of the year by a whole bunch of different companies.
It was a great book, which sounds like a brag, and I guess it is, but really it was because I was given an incredible story. Console Wars for me was a life-changing experience. Prior to that, my day job was trading commodities for Brazilian clients. You know, I was trading sugar, coffee, and soybeans and daydreaming about becoming a writer. So writing Console Wars did change my life. And after that, and the reason I said that to my manager was because I just didn't think I would ever find a topic that had such an interesting intersection of technology, entertainment, culture, pop culture, and most importantly, characters. And then I became aware of Oculus and Palmer, and not just Palmer, and not just John Carmack, but there are a lot of other colorful characters like you mentioned.
And did you become aware of it because of the Kickstarter campaign, or were you speaking to some people in the field who said there's this interesting thing happening?
That's a good question, because the I wish that I could say, oh, yes, the first day of the Kickstarter, I saw it and I knew that this was the future and this would be my next book. But what really happened was, because Console Wars was such a life-changing experience for me, because for the first time people were wanting to interview me, the first place to do so was Popular Mechanics, and they did a profile on me that came out on Mother's Day in 2014, and I was having lunch with my parents, and my mom was all very excited. This was a really big deal in the Harris household that her son was going to be in Popular Mechanics. And so I went to the bodega in the middle of our brunch and was, you know, going to skip ahead to the part about me. But I was struck by this cover story about this 19-year-old kid, Palmer, and Oculus. And I had heard about the company before, but never really thought about it seriously until that moment.
So that's how Oculus got rolling, the Kickstarter campaign. Investors and entrepreneurs learned about what Palmer had done, and he raised $2.4 million. So that's a lot more than he had expected.
Sure. And, you know, in many ways, I always say that everything I write with my grandmother in mind. I want it to be accessible to somebody who doesn't know about technology.
You mean me?
Yes, but also me. You know, I've written two books about video games and technology, but I'm not a hugely knowledgeable technologist. And so in that respect, I sort of see this book as just a story about entrepreneurship, as a modern-day American dream story. And so to that end, I think it's important to note that while we've spent so far talking about Palmer, and Palmer is an incredible guy, and there'd be no Oculus, there'd be no VR revolution without Palmer, that it is so much of a team effort. And so even before the Kickstarter, one of the pivotal moments that happened was Palmer was introduced to a guy named Brendan Areeb, who went on to become the CEO of Oculus, and basically he became the initial investor.
He had been a co-founder with another person involved, Michael Antonov, of Scaleform.
Yes.
And they were called the Scaleform Mafia.
That was a tongue-in-cheek description, but I think it's a fitting one. They certainly never murdered anyone as far as I'm aware, but they were such a close-knit group of Brendan, Mike Antonoff, who you mentioned, Nate Mitchell, and those three guys became the co-founders with Palmer. And to also get to your earlier question about when did Palmer start thinking about this beyond gaming, I think that very much, as we know from the Kickstarter, it was focused on gaming, but Brendan largely was a huge reason why the scope of what they were doing expanded. To that point, Palmer wanted to, only try to raise $50,000 or $100,000 on Kickstarter. And Brendan said, no, we should try to raise $1 million. They ended up settling on $400,000, but I think Brendan ended up being correct about the potential of this.
And they got $2.4 million. Another person involved was Joe Chen, who contributed to hardware development. And also, he led the non-gaming developer relations. So they were already thinking about going beyond gaming from the start.
Joe was a pretty early hire, and he did a lot of the events. You know, a big part of this, there's that line in The Matrix where Lawrence Fishburne as Morpheus says, I can't describe The Matrix to you. You have to see it for yourself. And that is one of the big marketing challenges with virtual reality. You know, we could sit here for an hour and talk about how it's the coolest thing ever, and it is a pretty cool thing.
I've only had one experience with it, and I thought it was okay.
Yeah, and you know,
I didn't want to run out and buy something.
What was the experience?
I was on the air, and somebody brought in head. I don't remember the reason, but I saw a little virtual reality while I was on the radio. And tried to describe it.
And I'm sure it was hard, because it's hard to convey that. It's like describing television on the radio. And I think that your reaction and your experience speaks volumes about why it was important to have someone like Joe Chen, because you try this thing that you've heard a lot about, and you form such a strong, you're not running out the door to go buy this. And that's what they needed people to do. They needed to demo this in a way with great content and in a comfortable way to get people to run out the door, because if you don't have a great first experience, you're probably not going to try it again.
And John Carmack, who you mentioned earlier, joined Oculus VR. They were now calling it Oculus VR as its CTO in August 2013. And that led later to a lawsuit by the company that he'd come from, id, the parent company, ZeniMax.
Yeah.
They sued Oculus.
Yeah, ZeniMax had acquired John Carmack's company, id Software, a few years before this. And then, you know, there is no denying that John Carmack and Paul Merluckey collaborated, and that it was a mutually beneficial relationship, and that John helped with technical details. So it was very odd when ZeniMax launched a lawsuit alleging theft of trade secrets, but it's maybe not so odd when you consider the timing of it, which came a month after the Facebook acquisition for a few billion dollars, and that was the first time that they had ever mentioned the potential, you know.
Was there a strong case that software patents had been violated?
I didn't think so. I spent 3.5 years working on this book and found that they had an incredibly thin case. You know, I think it's my job as a journalist to try to see things from everyone's perspective. So I really tried to put myself in their shoes and see it, and I couldn't. And part of that too, like I said, I just, you know, I think it's objectively undisputable that John did help with the technical details of Oculus, and everyone at Oculus would agree. But part of what's interesting about John is that, you know, part of his legendary status and his why he's so beloved and called Carmack the Magnificent by the community is because he's such a proponent of open sourcing and openness. And so he actually has written into his contract that he is allowed to talk with hardware makers and to share this information. And Oculus was not the only one he was sharing it with.
Well, if you're a developer of software, if you have any kind of job and then you move on to another place, you're bringing what you learned at that previous place with you. As long as you don't actually break patent laws, you are... You know stuff that you wouldn't have known otherwise if you hadn't worked at that previous place.
And that's what made the case so interesting, because John explicitly made that point. He said that ZeniMax owns my code. And again, with his special contract, they were not allowed to file for patents based on his work. But he basically said they don't own my brain. They don't own my experience. If I'm going to Oculus and doing similar things but differently, like you don't have a claim on that.
So has that case been resolved to everyone's satisfaction?
Well, Leonard, no case is ever resolved to anyone's satisfaction.
Speak to Paul Manafort. Huh?
Yeah, he can't be too upset with what he got. There was a jury trial in January of 2017. The end result was that Oculus, you know, ZeniMax was seeking $3 billion.
Ooh.
They ended up getting $500 million. But none of it was related to trade theft or trade secrets. It ended up being issues like false designation, which really meant that, like, in the Kickstarter video, Oculus had shown a clip of John Carmack endorsing it, and the jury felt that was misleading to make it seem like ZeniMax was somehow involved. Again, I found that very thin. I also found it hard to believe that was worth $500 million, given that they raised $2 million. And I guess I was not alone in my skepticism, because that ended up being overturned. So in the end, I think that Oculus was very happy with the verdicts upon appeal. But the case itself is pretty interesting and also kind of indicative of how a lot of things work in Silicon Valley.
Now, what was Oculus's plan to manufacture the headsets by itself?
The plan from the start... and I'm glad you mentioned Joe Chen, because I remember talking to him, and Joe, in a lot of ways, represented my perspective in the book, because he was a layperson. He was not a gamer, but he loved this technology and loved the potential of it. And so I remember Joe talking about his first meeting with Palmer and with Brendan, and he, like me, was thinking, okay, this is a really cool thing, or like you, thinking it's an okay thing, but, you know, basically what...
Oh, if it becomes available at a reasonable price, I probably will wind up getting it.
Yeah, but anyway, the point is, there's a lot of cool things in the world, but can you build a business around it? How do you scale it? What is the actual plan here? And Joe was really delighted to learn that Brendan, who had experience with Scaleform and other software companies, said, we're making... the best, most affordable hardware virtual reality headset of all time, but our business model is the software. Our plan is to create a store like the Apple, iTunes Store or Google Play, and that's how we're going to make our money. And so we are going to basically be a virtual reality distribution company.
The most of the Silicon Valley companies do their manufacturing in China.
Yes.
Or other parts of Asia. Was Oculus planning to do it here in the United States?
Really great question.
Is the hardware readily available in this country in any quantity?
The answer is no. Early on, Oculus brought on a guy named Jack McCauley. He was also a co-founder of the company. He came in before the Kickstarter, and he was instrumental in getting the manufacturing done. And Palmer, who at various points throughout the book is a very proud and loud American, and it's no surprise perhaps now that he's working in the defense industry, but he asked Jack McCauley, can we make this in America? Even if it costs a little more money, I want to do a made American thing. And Jack said, no, that's not how we'd make things. That's not how we do things here anymore. And so, there is a fun chapter about Nate Mitchell and Palmer Luckey's first adventure to China and just seeing how the sausage is actually made. I don't know of many, if any, Silicon Valley companies that do all their manufacturing here.
But because, as you point out, Palmer Luckey, we'll get into his yes. patriotism in a little bit. Because we're going to take a little break here. I am going to, before we go to the break, I'm going to throw out a little tease. You say that when you began writing this story, you had no idea that it would somehow involve Donald Trump, billion-dollar lawsuits, illegal practices, and end with Luckey, the boy wonder, ousted from Facebook as one of the most polarizing figures in Silicon Valley. So when you realized that, you knew that you had an interesting book.
I did, and the manuscript was originally due September 2016. I ended up turning it in September 2018. So it took me an extra 2 years to get the story, but I'm glad that I did.
Well, you had a lot of access, didn't you?
Yeah. That was why I felt like, my publisher at first wasn't too psyched about me needing more and more time, but I felt that, that rabbit hole of stuff that you just described was really important to describe, and I had this unprecedented access with Facebook that I felt a responsibility to make sure I got it right.
And we'll get into that story in just a moment. My guest is Blake J. Harris. His book, The History of the Future, Oculus, Facebook, and the Revolution That Swept Virtual Reality. It is published by Day Street, which is an imprint of HarperCollins. You're listening to Leonard Lopate at Large. How long after Oculus had been in business did Mark Zuckerberg enter the picture?
Good question. So Mark first entered the picture in January of 2014, and that would have been about a year and a half after Oculus was founded. And Mark, he's admitted this before and through a lot of the leaked documents that I received and sort of private video clips, he's openly admitted that one of his biggest regrets with Facebook is missing out on mobile, in the same way that Apple and Google have really planted flags with the iPhone and with the Android operating system. Facebook has always been, in his mind, beholden to them by being just an app on their platforms. And so he, that fear of missing out or that visionary mentality led to him wanting to be early with the next computing platform. And he believed after visiting Oculus that that next computing platform was going to be virtual reality. And so he made a big bet and continues to make a big bet to this day.
And you quote a speech that he gave in which he said about virtual reality, quote, "People describe it as like a religious experience. They go into the world by putting on a pair of supercharged goggles, and when they take it off, they're like sad to be back to reality." He sprinkles a lot of likes into his speech, which is not surprising considering he's a premillennial, isn't he?
I think he's about my age, but I think that was important. That is the opening line to the book, I think, in the prologue. Yeah. And I wanted people to see right off the bat that this was, based on actual video. So much of this book is based on archival information. And also so much of it is just the real story. That's how people actually talk. It isn't the movie version of Mark Zuckerberg that maybe we know from Social Network.
So was he talking specifically about Rift when he made that speech?
He's talking about the DK2. So what Oculus ended up doing was instead of right out of the bat with the Kickstarter trying to sell to people like us, to the consumer, They wanted to target video game developers so that they can create an ecosystem of content so that by the time they made it available to us, there would be a lot of games and experiences. So he was talking about a development kit that Oculus had made.
Didn't Legendary Pictures announce this past November that it planned to adapt the previous book we talked about, Console Wars, into a limited edition TV series with Seth Rogen, Evan Goldberg, and Scott Rudin on board? Would that be done as a virtual reality TV show?
Well, it's a good question. I think the first thing to mention is, like I said before, with the teaser before the break, I ended up spending 2 years longer on this than I had expected to. And so one might wonder, Blake, if you were not making money for 2 years, how did you survive? Fortunately, my first book had sold and is going to be adapted into a television show. I also should do a quick shout out and thank you to my wife for financially supporting me and being supportive during that time. But yeah, we're making the series. We just got a copy of the pilot script. It's coming along really well. And I would love for there to be a virtual component. I think that part, like you said earlier, part of this is a cautionary tale. And to some degree, it's I think that one of the mistakes that Oculus made was being too precious about virtual reality. And I think that there's a really big market for supplemental content. So whether it's a popular TV show that is like producing additional content that's only available in VR, or maybe a VR version of what is there, I think that is a really good way to appeal to users because you already have this known quantity. Whereas a lot of people in Oculus leadership felt that everything needed to be built from the ground up for VR.
So this may very well wind up with a situation similar to what's happened with 3D, where certain films are shown both in 3D in certain theaters and just regular projections in other theaters.
It's good. It's great that you brought up 3D. First of all, yes, that's exactly correct.
Because this is a kind of a 3D experience,
right? And 3D televisions, which were popular or seemingly popular around this time, starting of Oculus, that was always like the cautionary tale that they wanted to avoid. Where again, as with a virtual reality headset, most people who see a 3D movie think like, all right, that's very cool. But are you going to spend the extra money to do it? Are you going to want to have a special television in your home? And the answer back then was no, at least to the home entertainment. And with movies, there still are 3D movies. And I think just in general, 3D is a good way to think about it, because when we, all of our lives, especially when we look at screens, it's two-dimensional things. It's a two-dimensional photograph. It's a two-dimensional television. And what you have with virtual reality and augmented reality is the potential for 3D and 3D interactive content.
It has been pointed out that for many of us, depending on how old we are, black and white flat is more real than color. And now we're going to have to adjust to this whole other brave new world. You tell the story in great detail and include a huge cast of characters and even have some photographs in the book. How did you come to gain access for the story from Oculus and Facebook over, 3.5 years?
Yeah, so before that 3.5 years, and going back to when I told you about that popular mechanics issue on Mother's Day and how I became interested in the story, I was initially introduced to Palmer Luckey. And Palmer, who then was 21, said something that I thought was pretty mature when I suggested the idea of doing the book. And he said that in his opinion, Oculus had accomplished nothing yet. They had just sold to Facebook for a few billion dollars, but they hadn't delivered on the promise of virtual reality like they had set out to do. But at the same time, he knew that a lot of journalists were looking for access, and he really liked my first book. And so I had hoped to get access pretty quickly. It ended up taking from summer of 2014 until February of 2016 for me to finally get it. And then the next 3 years were very interesting ones.
And you were able to conduct exclusive interviews with key players. You got 25,000 internal documents.
Yeah. It was like Christmas morning for me all the time, getting all these documents. And especially compared to my first book, which is, Console Wars, the love of my life, but it happened 25 years ago. There were not emails back then. There were so few internal documents that survived. So for me to have that as a reporter, that's invaluable. And it's also a great barometer for how honest people are being with you, and also how well they remember things, because I often basically had the truth to compare their memories to, and maybe sometimes they didn't even know that, but so much of this book to tell the story that to tell the kind of story that my grandmother would like, or that you would like, or that anyone out there who doesn't know that much about VR would like. It is based on telling the story about these people, getting inside their minds, and so getting that access was critical. And it was at a very interesting time. February 2016 was when it started. This was 1 month before they launched their first consumer product, the Oculus Rift, the CV1 consumer version 1.
They did that because they had that infusion of $2 billion
yes.
now?
Yeah, so they had they launched the first developer kit in 2013.
And were they manufacturing in China?
They were still manufacturing in China, but with a different. But it's interesting because they actually changed manufacturers, and one could make the case that you should dance with the one that brought you there. But once they became a part of Facebook and had all this money, they wanted to have the quote unquote best of the best. And I mention that because they I think it's their launch was a disaster. They didn't produce the quantities that they had planned to do in time. They lost a lot of goodwill with the VR community for failing to do so and for their messaging around it, which I think is just very indicative of how the company changed once they became acquired by Facebook.
We've seen that in a number of high-tech situations. Tesla is going through that right now. Okay, so they gave you a lot of access, and then things went sour. What happened?
So we should probably So things went sour 2 years later in April of 2018, so early last year. But we should probably backtrack a little bit from that to talk about Palmer and to talk about what happened. And so in September of 2016, this was about 6 weeks before the presidential election. It was revealed, or there was a story that was published with the headline
in the Daily Beast.
Yeah, in the Daily Beast, a story about Palmer. With the headline, Facebook billionaire secretly funding Trump's meme machine. And the insinuation was very much that every online GIF or meme that you've seen over the past election season that was hateful, misogynistic, anti-Semitic, all these terrible things, that Palmer Luckey was the internet troll running this operation behind it all. That turned out not to be true at all. But what was true was that Palmer was and still is a supporter of Donald Trump. And what ended up happening, the behind the scenes of that, well, I guess this is already behind the scenes because the journalists didn't do a great job covering it, but the behind the scenes with that was the story comes out, there's a lot of inaccurate information, and Palmer, like anybody who's facing a PR disaster or a PR backlash, is going to issue a statement. So he writes a statement explaining what is true, what is not true, explaining what this group was, explaining his support for Donald Trump, and explaining why he's supporting Donald Trump, because he knew it was a very unpopular opinion in Silicon Valley, so he wanted to at least explain his reasoning.
Did Zuckerberg have a position, a political position?
Yes. So the Daily Beast story came out on a Thursday evening, and a lot of us were surprised that Palmer did not issue a statement that night. And originally, the plan was to issue one right away, and Palmer is always very aggressive and reactive on the internet. So it seemed very un-Palmer-like. And then 24 hours later, even more un-Palmer-like was the statement that was actually published. He has a very authentic style to his voice, and which, you know, I think is a large reason why people are attracted to him and why he was a good ambassador for virtual reality. And in his public statement, he said that it was a very corporate-sounding statement, but he also, the most interesting part was that he said that he was planning to support Gary Johnson in the upcoming election.
The third-party candidate,
Gary Johnson, which I knew was not true unless he had changed his mind because, as sort of a disclaimer here, I'm very much a vocal opponent of Donald Trump. I don't like him at all, and I was very scared about the prospect of him winning the presidency. So I had spent a lot of time talking to Palmer in the months prior to that about why did he support Donald Trump or what was I missing or, you know, because Palmer is a brilliant guy. I wanted to know how could such a smart guy support him. And Palmer was helpful in helping me understand why some people would support him. But I guess
that's another show. We have to you have to tell me what he said.
I think the short version is actions over rhetoric. And so to me, as a storyteller, as someone who thinks words matter, I think that when Trump says things, it makes a difference. And Palmer thinks that the results are really all that matter. What are the actual policies?
People see him as a game changer and they're ready to overlook all the other things.
Right. And I will say that as much as I really dislike Donald Trump, and and would maybe was initially disappointed that Palmer was a Trump supporter, I think that everybody has the right to support a major political candidate. And this apparently separates me from Mark Zuckerberg, because the statement that Palmer ended up posting was written personally by Mark Zuckerberg, and he was the one who put in the part about Palmer supporting Gary Johnson, and Palmer had to post this in order to keep his job. And so going back to your question of why did the access come to an end, the access came to an end because, first of all, I didn't know this for a long period of time, but I told the people at Facebook that I needed to explain why Palmer left the company. He was the main character of the story. I can't just have a chapter end with, oh yeah, and then he ended up exiting the company.
Well, first he was exiled for a time.
Yes. Yeah, there was this.
Because they felt the politics had damaged their reputation? Are they that concerned that a Trump supporter was attached to this company?
Yes. Yes, the answer is sadly yes.
Because I'm sure there are a fair number of Trump supporters who would buy VR consoles or whatever will become available.
Yes, I won't name who, but about a high-ranking executive at Oculus who was part of firing Palmer said to me, it was asked rhetorically, like, Blake, what would you have done given the backlash? And having the benefit of hindsight and also the benefit of actually doing my research into what this organization was, which Facebook didn't really do, I told him I would have let Palmer written his own statement. I would have let him explain to his colleagues what actually happened. And I would have saw him as an asset instead of a liability because, like you said, you know, half the country – or there's Trump supporters out there. You know, publicly, we all saw a lot of hate directed at Palmer for his supporting Trump or even for the incorrect information aspect of the troll – the troll allegations. But privately, because I had this great access and this relationship with Palmer, he shared dozens of messages that he got from Trump supporters who were sending him messages saying, like, you know, we stand with you, we're going to buy a Rift just because of this. So I feel like what Facebook was doing there was just not fair, and it was actually illegal in California.
When did you learn that Oculus employees had been instructed to lie to you?
So that happened around February of 2018. It was a couple months before my access came to an end. It was when I was telling them, look, I need to explain to readers what happened. Maybe I won't have all the information. Maybe you're bound by NDAs. Palmer certainly was. He was not allowed to talk to me about any of this stuff after he was fired. But I said, I need more information. And they gave me more information, and it turned out to be completely inaccurate information, going so far as to deny that he was exiled from the company. But exile can be, like, semantically to make sure that there's no mistake here. Palmer was not allowed in the office for the 6 months after after this incident, except for one day, and that was because he was on campus to prepare for the legal proceedings. So they denied that that happened, which I knew that was the first clue to me. All right, you guys are telling me a story that doesn't seem to add up. They told me it was his choice to leave. And again, knowing what I knew about Palmer, that seemed untrue. And I also, you know, there was an email that he sent on that one day he was allowed back in the office and said he planned to be there for the next 50 years. So
didn't he tell Joe Chen that he had no intention of becoming another Eduardo Saverin?
Yeah, so that was –
Eduardo Saverin had been Mark Zuckerberg's early partner?
Yeah, Eduardo Saverin was played by Andrew Garfield in The Social Network. That's probably why we know his name outside of the Valley. Like I said, there's a lot of stuff that Palmer could no longer speak to me about because I assumed he had signed an NDA, even though I think part of the NDA was that he couldn't tell me he signed an NDA. But what he could talk to me about was, like, his emotional state. And so going through all this and then after being fired – he was the most vulnerable I'd ever seen him. I was a little bit worried about him, in fact, because he felt, you know, not only was he the founder of this company, he really was the face of the company and the face of this entire industry. So to lose all of that in one fell swoop and then be pushed out of the company, it was really like an existential crisis for him. But to his credit, and also with the help of people like Joe Chen and other people that he trusted and, you know, people he found to be his actual friends, he was able to found a new company called Honorol, which is a defense technology company, and they've been extremely successful in a short amount of time.
He also uncovered illegal practices. Mark Zuckerberg has come under a lot of criticism recently, and I don't think this book is going to help his case very much.
Yeah, it certainly didn't help my opinion. Coming into this, I had a very neutral opinion of Facebook, and I still am not someone who thinks, oh, Facebook is this evil company, but I think that they're a company that has a lot of power, and that power is very unchecked, and I think that some of the things they're doing are inappropriate, and a lot of them have been
But how would I know about all my friends' birthdays coming up if I wasn't on Facebook?
Well, that's a pet peeve of mine, because now if someone wishes me a happy birthday, I think, oh, you just saw it on Facebook. You're not it devalues the value of someone remembering your birthday. But you know, it's interesting. Over the past year, there have been all of these scandals related to Facebook, from the Cambridge Analytica to other privacy concerns, or even just 2 days ago with Elizabeth Warren having her ads suggesting that we consider breaking up Facebook being banned by Facebook, and all this, the power that they have as the public square. But what I find very significant about my book and the research, you know, basically what my research led to, is that every other Facebook scandal or controversy or concern, Mark can sort of wave his hands and say, I didn't know that was happening. Those were unintended consequences. That's someone else's problem. But this is, you know, he personally drafted the statement for Palmer to lie about his politics. And that directly puts Mark at the scene of the crime. And so to me, that is significant.
Oculus promised to deliver high-quality, immersive, and affordable virtual reality to consumers. So what has happened over the last couple of years? What have they put any products on the market? Can I just go to my local Best Buy or Staples and buy an Oculus product?
Because
I haven't seen
Unfortunately,
a
you can't go
there.
To Staples yet. It hasn't really moved that much in the productivity space. But yeah, you can go to Best Buy. And in fact, it's interesting you bring up Best Buy, because in terms of what had happened, how did they take this thing that everyone was excited about and that Mark hoped there would be 50 to 100 million headsets by now? Part of it was because originally when they were selling the headsets, they sold them on their website and they sold them for $300. But they decided that they needed to sort of go big or go home with the consumer version launched in 2016. And they partnered with retail chains like Best Buy, and that increased the price of the headset dramatically. So they were selling it for $500 or $600. So almost just that price point alone was like a betrayal of their initial mission.
And now they have two different types of products. They have a PC-VCR combination that sells for around $1,500, and something for around $100 that's powered by a smartphone. I can't imagine that would have very high quality.
Right. So along the way, they sort of split in two directions by design. There was the PC VR, which is the high-end experience. Now, $1,500, you could probably, if you know how to find a good deal, probably get it for $1,200. And then there's the mobile VR, which you snap onto your phone, which is not a very high-quality experience. And it's interesting that the CEO of Oculus, negotiated this deal with Samsung that made that possible. But all the while, he himself didn't even believe in it. He just wanted to deal with Samsung so that Samsung, because Samsung was one of the two companies that made the screens that Oculus wanted for the high-end version, and sort of like as a little horse-jockeying there, they were able to get the screens. But your point, there's always been this idea of poisoning the well. You know, VR is has such a up and down history. A low-end experience might have killed the market.
And now they've announced that they'll be launching a standalone headset called Quest in the next few months for $399.
Yeah. So,
and how would that work?
So the Quest headset is basically taking the two hands of what you described. There's a high-end experience that's very expensive, but you need a computer to plug it into. And then there's a low-end experience that is untethered, and you know, you could take it anywhere with you. And the Oculus Quest, which comes out this spring, so in a couple of months, and it's going to cost about $400, is a somewhat affordable experience that you don't need to be plugged into a computer for. And really, despite my complex opinions about Facebook and my everything I've gone through the past few years, I could easily say it's the best technologically speaking and affordability wise, it's the best headset out there. But then you get into an issue of I was asked at a book signing last week by a VR fan who said, I really like the Oculus Quest. It looks like it's something I want to buy. But would you recommend I buy it as someone who's very concerned about Facebook and the way that they use my data? And I had to basically say, I don't know, because something that we haven't really talked about, but is a really big part of this, and something that we should all think about is virtual reality or even augmented reality, it is a way more intimate technology than any we've had before. Not just because it's close to your face and close to your eyes, whereas, you know, at a phone is at a distance, but it actually tracks your eyes. There's cameras and it uses computer vision to know what's in the room with you.
So there are privacy concerns?
Yes.
I never would have imagined that as a problem.
So there's privacy concerns, and unfortunately, the worst case, as I game it out in my head and trying to answer the young man's question at the book signing, was, you know, hopefully as journalists and investigators, we can get assurances from Facebook that they're not doing certain things. But then I think about Facebook's track record over the past 3 or 5 years, and so often I feel like what they say doesn't end up being what they're actually doing. And so how can you trust this company, even if they claim that they're not going to use that data for different things?
And now, of course, there are concerns about a trade war with China.
Yes.
And that's where Quest will be manufactured?
It will be. It'll be a pawn in the trade war.
You mentioned Palmer Luckey has created another company. Is that going to be a success? And is he still considered a polarizing figure in Silicon Valley?
Great question. I think, first of all, to create a company that survives even for just 6 months, any startup, is a success. So Palmer started his new company about a year and a half ago with Joe Chen and a few others. And so it's still around. So that's successful. But they've also gotten a lot of government contracts and have been cited on a lot of lists of, like, potential next unicorn billion-dollar companies. So it's been a success in that regard. But in terms of whether Palmer's still polarizing, I think this book has been very helpful in providing the real story to change that a bit. But you know, to sort of capture the sense of hysteria that there was in 2016, the article I always think of was an article a piece from Wired. And, you know, Wired has always been one of my favorite tech magazines. I think it's a very reputable one. But they had a headline that was, the story was just, Palmer Luckey is the worst, but he doesn't represent Silicon Valley. So people really did think that Palmer was the worst, and a lot of people still do.
Simply because of the Trump support? Or because of other things that he's done?
I mean, you have to remember that they were somewhat operating on information about Palmer, you know, operating this meme factory, so I give them the benefit of the doubt. But I do suspect that given the way that article is framed in terms of donations between the point of the article was that Silicon Valley makes a lot of donations to the Democratic Party. I have to imagine that it was largely political.
Well, we're seeing that in a number of other instances. There are people right now who are boycotting Starbucks because of the presidential campaign.
Right. Schultz.
Howard Schultz. So later this month will be the fifth anniversary of Facebook's $2 billion acquisition of Oculus. As of now, does it look like it was a good investment?
I have to say no. I nobody that I've spoken with at the company seems to feel that way, but they also have an incentive to not think that Mark made a mistake. To me, I think that Mark was... I think that in the long run, Oculus will be very successful, and that Facebook's investment in AR and VR would be a good thing. So perhaps the $3 billion, you know, it will just be somehow $3 billion will be moot just because of the long term success. But where I start to think that the reason that I call it not successful is not so much because of the number of headsets they've sold, but because of what they acquired. You know, Mark has said in the past that the reason he acquires companies is for the people. And he had bragged about never losing founders once they were acquired before. And almost every single person that I spoke with over the course of these 3.5 years ended up leaving the company either by choice or by being fired. So I have to wonder, what did he buy if it wasn't for the brain power, it wasn't for these people? And also, as we see, it's not just Oculus. We see the founders of Instagram leaving, the founders of WhatsApp leaving. So there's something going on there that is not creating a conducive environment for these people.
It seems to be another problem is that, a lot of people buy the Quest headsets or the glasses that come along, whatever, but you still have to have content.
Right.
Is somebody producing content for these things?
Yeah, there are a lot of developers.
Except for gaming?
Yeah, there are, and that's where I would, there's a lot of things that I would ding Facebook with, and I certainly have over the past 20 minutes. But as a fan of VR, I do think that they deserve a lot of credit for making not just the $3 billion investment in Oculus, but investing a lot of money over the past 2 to 3 years on content, other things like that, to help create this ecosystem. I think at the end of the day, you know, the book starts off with Mark talking about this religious experience and comparing it to the rise of VR. He believes it's going to be like the mobile platform. He doesn't want to miss out on it. But I think at the end of the day, it's actually going to be a lot more like the PC revolution, where, you know, you have Apple in the late 70s being this tech darling. And they did change the game, but it really was for more of an enthusiast audience. And my family didn't own a PC until 1995. So it took 15 years or so after the PC revolution. And I think it's going to be a similar thing with VR. I don't think it's going to take 15 years, but I think it was very naive to assume that by next Christmas, everyone was going to have a headset.
Blake J. Harris's book for Day Street is The History of the Future, Oculus, Facebook, and the Revolution That Swept Virtual Reality. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you so much for having me. This really was a bucket list moment, and you have the most wonderful voice in the business.
Oh, thanks. And that brings us to the end of our show. My great thanks to Blake J. Harris, to Charlie Morrow, who composed our theme music, to Reggie Johnson, who was at the audio controls, and to my executive producer, Jesse Lent. Leonard Lopate at Large comes to you on Saturdays at 4 and Tuesdays at noon. You can subscribe to Leonard Lopate at Large podcast on iTunes and by clicking on Robinhood Radio's archive program site, which is robinhoodradio.com. You can also check out Leonard Lopate at Large Facebook page. We hope to see you next week.